You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Silver Screen Podcast for this, a very special Halloween treat, a crossover episode between two podcasts, or, well, one and a half podcasts, but that's a long story, which we'll get into later. As you'll have seen on social media and, again, on our banner and everything, we're reviewing a particularly gruesome, scary movie for this sort of spooky season. We're going to look at The Thing. That's John Carpenter's original, not the 2011 prequel, which bizarrely has the same name. Don't get me started. But as usual, as I said, I am joined by my normal podcast co-host, DK.
Hello.
Or D. Creedy, as he's labelled himself, in I presume a vain attempt to try and look as cool as Kurt Russell.
But, he's saying I'm not. And...
I mean... Dude, you'll never be as cool as Santa Claus. Come on. And as I said, this was intended to be a crossover between us and the Big Screen podcast. Unfortunately, one of the Big Screen hosts, Will, couldn't be with us. You'll have seen him all throughout the two channels that we have, this and the Trek one. He's had a bit of an emergency, which I won't get into for the sake of his own privacy, but suffice to say it was an understandable sort of home emergency, which has meant he hasn't got power or the ability to join us today. But he has sent me through his conclusion and skull, which we will talk about at the end. But we do have the other half of the current Big Screen podcast lineup. Theo Stokes is joining us to talk all things The Thing.
Hello.
Theo with the very appropriate, was it Among Us, little avatar? So, yeah. It was thanks for joining us, Theo. It was nice that we were able to at least get three out of the four of us together for this. So,
glad to be here.
Awesome. And I'm presuming you've seen The Thing at least now, if not before.
Okay, so I've seen The Thing before, but it's been a while, so I might be a bit rusty, but I am familiar and I am. And yeah, I'll know most of the stuff we talk about. Don't worry.
That's fair enough. That's no problem. DK, I don't know why I'm asking this, but I'm assuming you've seen The Thing a lot of times, probably.
Once or twice. Yeah.
And I've seen it a couple of times already, but I did just literally a couple of days ago watch the Arrow video Blu-ray release that I recently got. Didn't have a chance to delve into the features, but my word, I thoroughly recommend getting it because there's a lot of stuff on there. But yeah, enough bragging. As if you are new to us, what we do here is we start off with a little kind of behind-the-scenes information and stuff, then we break down the film in just random categories that we have, acting, directing, etc. It's not necessarily linear, but if the conversation flows a certain way, that's where we go. If you haven't seen the movie, then beware of spoilers, obviously. We'll give conclusions, scores, audience interaction, and all of that business. We're already the next thing we'll move on to will be the behind-the-scenes section, which DK normally does. I think we have a little bit of information each, though, to share, and hopefully maybe even have a chat about, or maybe interesting to some people. So without any further ado, I'm going to pop on our behind-the-scenes music, and DK, as soon as you hear it, you can take us away.
Oh, yeah. Right, the plan to make this movie was going on for almost a decade before Carpenter came on board. Producer Stuart Cohen initially wanted Carpenter, but not having made Halloween at this point, Universal declined, preferring Toby Hooper, who had just had relative success with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Hooper envisaged an almost Moby Dick affair, with the creature being hunted down by an Ahab-type character. This didn't align with Cohen's vision, and the two parted ways. Discussions were then held with John Landis before he also passed, and the project finding its way back to the capable hands of Carpenter. So, just goes to show that studio heads back then were just as capable as they are today.
I ain't not at all.
Both John Carpenter and his partner at the time, Adrian Barbeau, have cameos in the movie. Carpenter himself is one of the Norwegians on the videotape recovered from the base. Or Barbeau, who moviegoers will know for her roles in other Carpenter movies such as The Fog and Escape from New York, is the voice of the chess computer MacReady disagrees with at the start of the movie. At around 15 minutes into the movie, the rescued dog wanders down a corridor, pauses at a door where a shadow of one of the base's inhabitants can be seen and enters. Carpenter wanted to keep the identity of the base member mysterious. As such, none of the actors in the production were used to cast that shadow.
Oh, didn't know that.
Now Rob Bottin, the creative behind the creature itself, overworked himself to such a point on set that he was hospitalized due to exhaustion. Stan Winston came in to work on the dog creature effects to take up the slack, but like a true gent, insisted that his work remained uncredited.
He does get a special thanks, though, because I did have that fact as well.
Oh, nice one. Now, several endings were shot for the movie. There was initially a happy ending, which saw MacReady in a military base back in civilization, having a blood test to confirm that he was not the creature. But Carpenter didn't actually like that ending. There was also a more downbeat one, where the entire crew died and the creature escaped once more in the form of a dog. Again, Carpenter wasn't that keen, and he preferred the ending that we ultimately got, the ambiguous one. The movie was a box office bomb, which dispirited Carpenter, as it's the movie he's most proud of. It was such a disappointment at the box office that Carpenter was dropped from a multi-picture deal that Universal had him under. Released in 1982, both this movie and Ridley Scott's Blade Runner had to compete with E.T., and neither stood a chance. However, since then, both have received the recognition they deserve and are both lauded as classics of the genre. It's safe to say that had The Thing been successful, Carpenter's career post The Thing would have looked very different in many ways. So I think it's kind of a blessing, as we wouldn't have had some of the movies that he's given us since.
Indeed.
And last one. In August 2003, a couple of diehard fans, Todd Cameron and Steve Crawford, ventured to a remote filming location in Stewart, British Columbia. And after 21 years, they found the remains of Outpost 31 and the Norwegian helicopter. The rotor blade from the chopper now belongs to Todd and rests in his collection of memorabilia from the movie.
Awesome. Oh, that's cool. Awesome. Nice. I just have a few things, as I said. So the first thing is related to what you were saying about the alternative endings. I did find that the writer Bill Lancaster's original ending had both MacReady and Childs turn into the thing. In the spring, the characters are rescued by a helicopter and greet their saviors with, "Hey, which way to a hot meal?" Quite a spooky alternative ending, but apparently Carpenter thought that was too shallow. In total, Lancaster did 4 drafts of the screenplay. The original novella on which it's based, which is called Who Goes There, did end with the base crew being victorious, defeating the thing, but worried that a bunch of birds that they see flying past might have been infected and could be spreading it to the rest of the world, much like the sort of paranoid projections that we see in this film. Carpenter opted to end the film with the survivors slowly freezing to death to save humanity from infection, believing that to be the ultimate heroic act. But eventually Lancaster wrote the ending we got, which eschews a Twilight Zone style twist or the destruction of the monster, as he wanted to instead have an ambiguous moment between the pair of trust and mistrust, fear and relief. So, and we'll talk about whether we think it worked or not later, but I think we all probably will end up liking it. Let's see, what else have we got here? As I mentioned, the film was based on a that was written a long, long ago, which has previously inspired a movie called The Thing from Another World in the 50s, a bit of a 50s B-movie. Carpenter is a fan of that film. You know that because he actually has the characters watching that film in Halloween 1978. So he'd already kind of shown an interest before he remade it. The stars of the original weren't too fond, unfortunately, of Carpenter's remake, calling it everything from vacuous, shallow, over the top to a great advertisement for JB Whiskey, which, fair. The film's initial premise, as in the original film, was based around the likes of the fear of communism in the wake of the Red Scare or the Reds Under the Bed stuff and the McCarthy hearings. This version has similarly been compared to other metaphors that might be more appropriate for the time, such as the fear of homosexuality, the HIV and AIDS epidemic, Cold War tensions, and post-Vietnam fatigued counterculturalism, as it's called. As DK already said, the only female presence in the entire movie is the chess voice, which is provided by Adrienne Barbeau, suggesting a perhaps a sort of undercurrent of toxic masculinity, particularly as the chess computer isn't treated very well, being called a cheating bitch, and with MacReady already emphasizing that he would rather destroy everything than lose, which kind of comes into play later. The Atlantic's Noah Bolatsky said that unlike typical horror genre films, women are excluded, allowing the thing to be identified as a fear of not being a man or of being homosexual. Vice's Patrick Marlborough considered the film to be a scathing examination of manliness, noting that identifying the thing requires intimacy, confession, and empathy to out the creature, but male frailty prevents this as an option. Trapped by pride and stunted emotional growth, the men are unable to confront the truth out of fear of embarrassment or exposure. Bolatsky noted that MacReady avoids emotional attachments and is the most paranoid, which is what allows him to be the hero. This detachment works against him in the finale, which leaves MacReady locked in a futile mistrust with Childs because each doesn't really know the other. And the very last thing that I wanted to say about this is, I have to mention this, it's a little bit shallow, but if you haven't seen it, there was a remake of this movie, a very short remake done with the characters from Pingu, which I'm going to have to link in the comments because it is brilliant. It is an episode of Pingu, but with the plot of the thing, and it is exactly as hilarious as you would imagine. So,
is this a real thing and not a parody?
It's a real thing. I mean, it's not. It wasn't an actual episode of Pingu. It was a parody made by somebody, but yeah. But like in the style of Pingu, so it's full-on stop-motion animated. It looks exactly like an episode of Pingu until, you know, people start bursting open and spider heads crawl around and what have you. But it was just weird. I think somebody put two and two together and were like, Antarctic setting, Pingu in the thing. So yeah, I think it's called The Thingu, and it is available to watch free on YouTube. It's only like 6 or 7 minutes long, but still pretty amusing. So yeah, that would conclude what I know, and that ends the behind the scenes section. So we'll turn off the jazz club music. So Theo, did you learn anything from all of that rambling or not?
The only thing I really knew from what you guys are saying is I knew about the whole Halloween, the thing from another world. I have seen The Thing from Another World.
Oh, cool. I have the DVD.
I was on BBC iPlayer, so I just watched it.
Okay. Fair enough. What did you think of the original, then, out of curiosity?
I quite liked it. I thought it was decent. Like, it's not amazing, but it's pretty decent.
For a 50s B-movie, it's one of the better crop. It's not as good as some of my favourites, but
I have given it a full review on my Letterbox.
Oh, okay, fair enough. I will link your Letterbox in the comments then as well. Slide.
That's one of the only films I've actually done a full review for. There's only like 6 so far. So you get too obsessed.
We're doing them all the time.
Yeah, I like to just get a film that gets me feeling somewhere, and I'm like, just gonna spend 20 hours doing this one thing.
With that out of the way, then we're going to move on to just talking about the movie in general. So if anybody has any thoughts or comments or wants to take any baton from us and run with it. The first thing that I personally have notes about is the writing and the plot. So if anybody's happy, I'll move on starting with that. The first thing I wanted to mention is the opening, which happens briefly in space, which is really the only kind of hint that the thing is necessarily like an alien being. It really reminded me of the opening of Predator, which similarly has like the sci-fi space setting for the first like minute and then doesn't for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I've got that in my notes as well.
Yeah, it's weird because the flying saucer, I think, as well looked terrible. So I really kind of wish they hadn't done that, because like if we'd seen it crashed, it would have been fine. But seeing it, I just thought it looked really cheesy in that opening sort of minute or so.
I believe I read that he wanted that in as part of a homage to the first one.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. I wouldn't have known that, you see. But okay, cool. Speaking of things we probably should have mentioned earlier, the dog being chased by the Norwegian team, obviously taking place somewhat in the middle of some action, is a plot thread that would be taken up by the prequel in 2011, which is apparently bad. I have to say that I was really intrigued. Every time I watch this movie, I'm intrigued to watch the prequel, but I know it has a terrible reputation. So literally just a few hours ago, earlier today, I was like, you know what? I'm going to look up and see just clips on YouTube from the prequel and see what they're like. It's terrible. It's absolutely atrocious. They use CGI instead of practical effects, which takes away the entire point of what makes this movie good. I'm interested to know what you guys think about the beginning, because I think this is... I miss the fact that it doesn't introduce us to any of the characters that we'll follow in the sort of outpost that we're following for the film. But I do like how intriguing this start is, and the fact that it doesn't feel the need to open with any kind of explanation. It's just in the middle of it. And you wouldn't necessarily know that the dog was a creature unless you speak Norwegian, which I did find out. Apparently the subtitles do translate. And if anybody Norwegians were in the audience, they would have been spoiled, because the chap in question apparently is saying, "What are you doing? Get the heck away from it. It's not a dog. It's a thing pretending to be a dog. Move back, you idiots." So yeah. But yeah, so what did you guys think of the start? Like, did you find it as intriguing as me? It's a little bit of a mystery. And the first time you saw it, did you kind of click that, like, hang on, this dog's clearly a monster?
I can't really remember it. I mean, it's been that long since I originally saw it, but I do remember being intrigued and not obviously pegging it straight away why they were shooting at this dog. I think it worked.
Yeah. I can't really remember if I was surprised by the fact or if I kind of immediately clicked that the dog was it either, because it was that long ago. But again, I still appreciate the actual nature of, yeah, like a mid-narrative joining in with the mystery. What about you, Theo?
I love the opening, honestly. Cool. I think it captures you immediately, because, like, without, like, you see the like you said, the spaceship landing, but then all of a sudden you're just in this like white wonderland, and you're following a dog, and then you just see some guy trying to shoot it in a helicopter. It's like, wait, what? You feel like you've missed something, and that's what I liked. Is like, oh, I've missed something. I gotta catch up with, see what's going on, and it's just interesting because it being in Norwegian, it doesn't give it all away. So yeah, you can kind of put it together like, oh, the dog's probably not a dog. There's still an air of mystery.
Yeah. And if not, you certainly would when, you know, the dog gets put in the kennels and that happens.
So yeah. I just looked on YouTube, the top comment, so frustrating when the Norwegians nearly solved the crisis only to be stopped by the Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, right?
You could argue that, I mean, there's so much... As far as we know, like, they do say the thing could survive in like a single cell, so killing the dog wouldn't necessarily have achieved anything, especially since they're trying to shoot it with a gun and not even burning it, you know. So it's like, even if they'd shot the dog, all that would happen is that they'd get shot and killed for animal cruelty. The Americans would take the dog in to autopsy it or just to give it a burial or whatever, and the thing would still take them over. So it's still kind of daft. But,
I suppose.
Speaking of daft, is there anything you don't like in the sort of this intro? And I will say I'm asking that because I just hate that it's so stupid that the Norwegian copter people blow themselves up.
Oh yeah,
in the dumbest way possible.
It's a proper Frank Spencer moment.
It's so stupid, and it just doesn't fit tonally. Because if the film had an air of, I guess, like satirical comedy or whatever, fair enough. But as it is, it just jars with me because it's like, come on, that is beyond dumb. But what about you two? Did you agree with me or no?
It does seem out of place, but it's you know, there's a certain suspension of disbelief when I think that I've grown accustomed to over the years. So,
is this your Mystery Science Theater 3000 logic again?
It is. I should really just relax. That kicks in. So I should, you know. So I watch it. It is a bit dumb, but I quickly forget about it.
Fair enough. Yeah, okay. What about you, Theo? Any thoughts, or I can move on if you haven't?
Honestly, I don't remember the bit where they blow themselves up, but that is a testament to that. It didn't bother me that much.
They go to throw a grenade and it lands in the snow, and then they try to dig it out of the snow, but can't, and it just blows up and takes like the helicopter and the pilot of the helicopter.
Yeah, he raises his hand back to throw the grenade, and his hand stops, but the grenade doesn't, and then just slips out of the back of his hand and into the snow.
So dumb, but yeah.
All right, that's stupid.
Yeah. Related to what you were saying, Theo, I love how this film goes to great lengths to show the kind of isolation that's going on. Like in the cinematography and the direction, it makes a point of massive wide shots of the outpost, showing that there's nothing around it. It's all just white, instead of like tight close-ups on the outpost to emphasize the camaraderie, I guess. And I noticed, like, pretty much straight away at this point in the movie that they go to Windows and he says, like, this radio's crap. I haven't been able to get anybody, haven't reached anybody for days. So you know that they can't just radio for help or whatever or tell anybody about this. So, again, it really emphasizes that isolation for me.
I know I'm jumping ahead, but I think the cinematography, especially in the opening, is just beautiful.
I think John Carpenter is incredibly underrated. Yeah, he's known as, you know, a B-movie horror director. But when you look at what he can do when he's given a budget, I think that Omen is just amazing.
Definitely. And I was reading something which I hadn't realized, because it's sort of a subconscious thing, I hadn't realized it until this time around because I'd read about it. But it's amazing how he uses, like, negative space, because it implies that something could be lurking off screen and could, like, at any time jump out or catch you or something. And that really, it's designed to keep you tense and keep you on edge.
Yeah.
And again, I was feeling the tension, but didn't really necessarily realize why on a conscious level. And that's clever.
He's a master at what he does. Oh, I mean, obviously definitely. he obviously learned a great deal with things like, you know, Halloween, and then the same kind of scenes are applied here later when Blair steps out. But I just think he's incredibly, I mean, I'm a big Carpenter fanboy, but I think he's incredibly underrated as a director.
I don't know if I'd say underrated, because I know a lot of people who do rate him, but definitely, I mean, he's one of the best. Certainly one of the best living horror directors. Yeah, deserves the praise for sure. But you all know by now what my opinion is of Halloween 78. So I don't really need to think about that anymore. In terms of, since we're in the middle of praising everything, let me do the opposite now. One thing that bugged me was that I didn't really think it was necessary to go to the Norwegian cabin, because at this point, like, the function would seem to be to clue the characters in a little bit, but at this point they have everything they would need anyway, and they're certainly gnu by the time they get back and the dog starts mutating and assimilating and stuff. So I was like, it just feels a bit like that's there to pad out the runtime to me. But I, by all means, if either of you disagree and have a reason why that scene's there, I'm open to hearing it.
I like that. I like that they do that, and I like that it sets up certain revelations later when they're bringing back the video cassettes and they're going through them. And also it does lead me into another stupid thing where they find the carcass, and their first thing to do is, let's fetch this back to our base.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially considering how it looks. I mean, it's quite obvious that there's something, and I did say it's a stupid thing to complain about when it almost didn't, because, again, you've got to just MST3K accept some of these things. But I was like, how do they just accept this alien creature and everything so readily? Like, nobody's questioning how this guy has, like, two faces and is all contorted.
They're all
stuff
around within about 10 inches of the thing. It's still smoking. None of them are wearing masks. I would be in the corner throwing up like a scene from The Exorcist.
Yeah. I mean, I get that you need to get there for the purposes of the plot, but I just found their acceptance and their sort of buying of the explanation and their immediate suspicion of knowing, oh, it could be anyone, a little bit too quick and kind of like, you've just learned of the existence of alien life and you're treating it like oh no, an alien was there. Never mind.
I do find the ironic thing, and I'm going back to something I read in Behind the Scenes. During that autopsy scene, Blair, Wilford Brimley, he's the one that's going, oh God, oh God, when he's like uncovering it. And apparently behind the scenes, everybody, all of the actors are in that scene, were actually feeling ill at this. And the only one that didn't was Wilford Brimley, because up until when he started acting in his 40s, he was a ranch hand. And he'd seen all this kind of stuff. So he was like really nonchalant about it. And everybody else was, oh, good God, what is that thing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's fair enough. My next note is kind of, it's mean, but it's kind of, I disagree with you because I say I don't think we needed the videotape exposition. At this point, it's like a hat on a hat because we've even been to the cabin and yet we're still watching the videotape. And I was like, there's a big revelation that like, oh, this ship's landed there and it's been there 100,000 years. And I was like, that doesn't affect anything at all. It doesn't matter to the plot. It could have arrived yesterday and it doesn't affect anything. So why is that there? Anyway, that was just my thoughts on that. What was I going
to
say?
I do like how they gave a little homage to the original movie in that in those video cassettes.
In what way? I've been intrigued.
Where they're doing that entire thing where they're spacing out the circumference of the ship.
Mm. Okay, cool. I'm assuming you've seen the original as well then.
Oh, yeah.
That is like a direct lift from the original, except in the original they like plant C4. Like, oh, I need to throw out this spaceship. Oh, let's blow it up. That's going to work.
Fair enough. Do either of you have a good reason why it has to be 100,000 years old?
See, I like the idea that it's, if it's that old, then it kind of infers that maybe like this isn't the only thing out there.
Mm.
And it kind of, I mean, like, it plays on the idea of like it could be, because if you were to talk about like it being like this was originally something to do with like the red nation or the communists, it kind of has that air of like there could be other things out there, but we're not aware of it. And it kind of says to this mystery of like, so is this a self-contained? Is this the only thing on that ship? Because it's a big ass ship. Yeah. But it's like, is it the? Surely it can't be just that one thing, because it's way too big.
I guess. I mean, I suppose it also adds to the tragedy of the fact that it could have taken over us before humans had evolved, even or whatever. But it was scuppered by the fact that it just ended up frozen in the ice, and we've been safe for it for all those thousands of years until some idiot started digging in there. You know,
it's kind of like AVP with like the whole of the Predators have been here all along, but they buried it because they got too scared.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Like I said, I think it adds to the whole like, don't be an idiot, don't explore things, don't thaw it out. But naturally, it's a horror film, so they all have to be a little bit dumb.
Americans more like Norwegian, blow it up.
Yeah, exactly. I will say I was a little bit unclear on kind of what the thing actually was and how it like takes you over and what it involves when it's absorbing you and whatever. But I did eventually figure out by the fact that it shows you like the dripping blood from the original corpse and stuff, that I was like, okay, so it's more an infection than a life form as we understand it, I guess. And its original form, if it ever had one, would probably just be like a virus, maybe. I don't know.
It's like the Flood.
Yeah, like from Doctor Who, absolutely, yeah.
Like a single touch and you're gone.
Yeah, because even every time we see what like could be a representation of it in both movies, it's just somebody that's taken over and then warped into a horrible, grotesque mess of teeth and their old face and stuff. So it's like, well, what does it actually look like then? But like I said, I think I figured, well, if it can be a single cell, I guess it's just an infection and you can't be touched. And that's how it spurts blood on you to take you over and crap like that. So, all right, I guess I'll go with it. I liked the tension of Blair acting really weird. Some would say weird, some would say sensible. And the way that gives you like the massive exposition through reading the journals and stuff, when they're like, we need to find out how he's feeling. And conveniently, he's just basically recapped what's going to be the plot for them. And I was like, all right, that's fair enough. I'll give you that, because at least one person's, you know, wise enough to be paranoid. But yeah, that obviously leads to more kind of distrust and everything. And the warning of they're not dead yet is a nice touch of like, oh crap, what could possibly happen? What was I going to say? But then, yeah, I'm not sure. I think, is it Blair at this point who's taken over, or they figure out somebody is? And what they say is, it can't be true. I've known him for years. He's my friend. And I was like, doesn't make a lot of sense with the kind of plot as it's presented, but it does kind of seem to reinforce the whole not knowing that they're secretly gay or they might have HIV or whatever, because that's something you hear a lot. It's like somebody comes out of the closet and you would hear somebody go, I've known him for years. He was a friend of mine. I had no idea.
That angle, but yeah, now you're bringing it up.
Yeah, because it doesn't really seem like a why would you say like he's been a friend for years if he's just been taken over by the creature? It doesn't really jibe, but I picked it up as more of a metaphor, like I said. But again, I could be reading too much into it, but I figured that makes a bit of sense. As I said, they constantly go to great lengths to emphasize that there's no escape and they're trapped. So the chopper being wrecked by Blair, you know, the fact that the argument breaks out because the blood stores have been destroyed, which I've said is very typical men. Like, instead of banding together and trying to work out something logical, it's just immediately like, who had access? Who's got the key? Who could it be? I don't trust any of you.
Yeah.
All right. which is a shame, because like I said, it would have been nice to, well, I guess it wouldn't really have fit the film the way it is, the nihilistic tone of it, but it might have been nice to show at least a little attempt for them to be like, all right, how do we figure out who's who? And when we know, let's band together. but
you do sense that, especially between people like MacReady and Childs, there's a bit of animosity already there.
I guess, yeah. And I never really picked it up as sheer animosity as much as the situation. Because at the end, they seem rather friendly when they kind of just resign to their fates.
No, I think if when you end up working with someone, you don't necessarily get along. You will get along just for appearance's sake.
Yeah.
But Yeah, and I just got that vibe. Maybe I've just been in too many of those situations myself. I'm just an irritable bastard. But
I know
yeah.
what you mean, because Childs comes off as that kind of character anyway. He's obviously aggressive to everyone. And he's the one that's very like, screw it, man. I don't, I trust any of you and I won't do this. And he's, I think, if I recall correctly, he's the one leading the charge about, like, keep MacReady out when they think he's been infected because he's been back to the site or whatever. So,
yeah. And I mean, you also get a bit of aggression between Windows and Palmer, but that does look like it from Palmer. That is more down to paranoia, where I think where the Childs and MacReady thing, I get the vibe that there's some kind of rubbing each other the wrong way, as it were, and prior to the events of the movie.
I think I was too distracted by the fact that the Blair thing, obviously, because it must have been taken over at that point, puts the seed of doubt into MacReady of keep an eye on Clark. And I was just acutely aware that he does, like, even when it's been disproven and Clark's clearly fine and even the blood tests come back fine and everything, MacReady still just seems to be like, I don't trust you.
Yeah.
So I was too busy focusing on that, but I can see what you mean, probably. I mean, there's going to be tension with them all, isn't there? That's the whole point.
Yeah, I also do like, I don't know if either of you guys picked up on it, when they go back to Blair after he's been locked up in the cabin for a while, and this is, before, he seems almost childlike in his insistence on wanting to come back.
Oh, yeah, I'm fine now. Let me back in. I just want to be back in. I'm fine.
Yeah, I'm all better now. I'm fine. I'm all better. I'm not going to be bad. You know, it just comes across it like this. It's a 4-year-old telling you.
Yeah. I appreciate the ambiguity as well, that we don't really actually know when Blair gets taken over. Because like I say, I said you could assume he was from the start, but not necessarily, because why would he be paranoid and writing in the journals and stuff? So it could be that it was when they locked him up that he was infected, and it deliberately kind of doesn't tell you that, which I like.
Yeah. I mean, my impression is once he was locked up, one of the infected people got at him at that point.
Yeah. Well, we see that there's.
It wouldn't make any sense for him to be acting the way that he would prior to that.
And I did read something that the reason that they cast Wilford Brimley apparently was because he's very good, but has the kind of presence that you don't entirely notice the absence of. And Carpenter was like, I knew that I wanted to effectively bench him early in the film, have him come back at the very end, but not have the audience miss him and wonder where he is for the entirety of the film. And I was like, that's fair. Actually, it's a good point. Because I'm never wondering, like, okay, so what happened to Wilford Brimley?
I don't know, because I'm a big Wilford Brimley fan, so...
Ah, okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
That makes sense. See, I didn't even know it was him, because he hasn't got the moustache. So it took me a long time before I realised it was him.
There's a guy that looks like a walrus. He's not in this.
Exactly, yeah. That guy from Cocoon? That's not him. Anyway. Theo, you've been very quiet. Have you any thoughts up to now about the film?
Yeah, so I'm a little bit, I get a little bit confused with names, as you know from other things, and like actors' names. But I do remember like the thing with the don't remember his name, but being like childish about come on guys, I hate to say it again, but it's very much like the flood thing, like where it's like 48 hours of quarantine, you know the rules, but she's like, oh, but come on, just let me out. It's that kind of like childish thing again, and then. I think it's true for all of the characters, but I agree with you that I like that we don't really know when people get taken over.
Yeah.
You
do when you see it, obviously, if it's somebody like
that
on it, then they're immediately, that's fair enough.
Like the guy gets his arms chomped off, like you're like, oh yeah, so he's done. But like,
well, he's dead anyway.
Yeah, but he's like, well, he's a game over for him. But it's like with some, like, especially with the ending, like I like the idea that you're not quite certain that they've been like when they've been taken over, or even how, because you could have like you would talk about, like, if he wasn't infected when he was initially in quarantine, then somebody else had to get him infected, and that already brings up like, okay, who else was infected then? Like, it already brings up the idea of like there's others in the room that are already infected and you don't know yet.
See, I read it, maybe this is because I'm too paranoid, but like I said, when I realized it was like a single cell is enough to take you over kind of thing, I was like, there's, we don't know, like, we presume he dug the tunnels and whatever underneath where he's trying to build something, but we don't know if there was something maybe under there the whole time, because it's not like it's a secure area, it's just more ice. And I was like, how scary would it be if he was locked up in quarantine? The thing, whatever it may be, kind of went to get him, and he was locked in there with it, and he was innocent the whole time. It was like, oh, that's a chilling thought,
It's a horrifying idea of, like, just... like mass hysteria and paranoia that like, even if someone is like 100% clear and innocent, like you were saying about Clark, I think you said, that there's still this air of like not trusting or not believing them, even though it's proven. And that kind of plays into the whole film rather well. I like that. You never get a sense that all the characters like each other or trust each other.
Oh, no, definitely
and
not.
And especially with the main character, is MacReady, is that how you pronounce his name?
MacReady, yeah.
But the only thing with MacReady is I feel like other people should trust him sooner, because I remember when the first thing gets outed and he has that massive speech of like, I know I'm not infected and I'm not dead, so I know some of you are not. You think the other guys would be like, right, he wouldn't be saying this if he was the thing, because he's basically just outed out the best technique to like clear the thing.
You say that, but you don't know how clever the thing is, because like I said, the fact that when it's got Blair, instead of being like aggressive and trying to break its way out, it's clever enough to be like, okay, I'm just going to pretend I'm fine and then see if it'll sneak me in. So you don't know how devious it could be. It could have been like,
you get a similar thing.
I know.
See, I always got like the intention that it was like it lays dormant until it's outed. Yeah. So that like what was his name? Sorry, the guy behind bars, the quarantine guy?
Blair.
Blair. Like I was under the impression, at least the first time I watched it, that Blair had it, but it wasn't activated yet. And it was like being patient. And then as soon as it was like outed, it was like, right, Hail Mary, I'm going to make myself a giant monster and try and kill these guys.
Yeah.
And obviously it fails because they burn him in a pretty...
obviously,
honestly, the only scary scene for me in the film is when he's like doing his, oh, in the snow. That's the only part of this film that I'm like, I don't like it. It's scary.
I didn't really remember, for whatever reason, the initial idea of them like suspecting MacReady and locking him out, and then him kind of aggressively forcing his way back in, and I'll kill you all if you don't let me in, and I'm frozen after death, and I look like Santa Claus, which I guess I will be in a few decades. So that struck me as a little bit odd, because I was like, I'm not sure how to feel about this, because obviously we know that he's not outed at that point in the film, but I kind of understand their suspicion, and I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't know if I would act any differently, to be perfectly honest. I'd be like, yeah, fuck it. Just leave him out there, even if there's a chance, I guess. I'm not actively killing him, but he's not getting in here.
So trolley.
And I probably wouldn't have let Knowles in either, like, but, you know, never mind. Speaking of Knowles, I also read in the behind-the-scenes stuff, apologies, I know there's a lot of this kind of crap, but I read somewhere that a relatively famous black comedian was almost cast in the role. He had a successful audition, but he didn't actually want the part. He used the opportunity to rant about how Knowles was just a big stereotype. And I was like, I kind of see where he's coming from, but I think he was a bit harsh. So I'd love to know if you guys think Knowles is also just a black character stereotype.
To an extent, you could say that. It's not without validity.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, the fact, the jive talk and the Stevie Wonder.
The large music and, the loud music.
I hate that the supposed hero kills Clark in cold blood and he was innocent the whole time. I was like, ooh, that doesn't sit well with me at all. But yeah, I do like that at least the film points it out, and when they realize he was innocent because of the blood test, it's like, I guess that makes you a murderer, don't it? It's like, yeah, exactly. I get it, though. I mean, that's the whole point, is paranoia can make you do horrible things. Go on, but still, don't love it.
But in fairness, I mean, it does put it forward so that you as the audience do suspect Clark for a lot of it until that happens. So it kind of throws the audience off balance as well, because by that point, you are convinced he's one of them.
Mm. Speak for yourself, but okay.
Well, you don't think...
Unless it was a clever ruse.
Yeah, I never suspected... Well, I don't know if I've suspected all of them, basically, because I'm that kind of person. So I'd be terrible in that situation, because I'd be locking myself in a room alone and being like, nobody come near me. I'm just a single one of you. I don't remember particularly, like, specifically thinking of Clark as, like, oops, suspicious. And I do think I was probably like, no, it's too convenient that Blair is just like, keep an eye on Clark. Ooh, I was like, well, because how would he know?
But Clark does act off, because, you know, the dogs, a couple of the dogs have just been killed.
Yeah, because he's a dog lover. I just assume that.
Yeah, but he has that same kind of, and I think it was intended that way, because when you first see the dog and they're going about the business, the dog is just there staring into space or staring out the window, and they give Clark that same kind of intensity. People are talking to him and it's just a thousand-yard stare.
I didn't notice that, but that's fair enough. I can understand where you're coming from with that. Yeah, I didn't pick that up, but it makes sense. Although I do remember somebody asking him how long he was alone with the dog, which I guess is also to put it in your head of like, he's had plenty of time to be taken over. Yeah. You never know.
Fair enough.
Obviously, this is the next scene that we would come to, so I have to say I really like the blood test scene. I love how cleverly they kind of point out the obvious, which is each individual cell is like its own separate animal. So that's why if you get the blood and, you know, hit it with something hot, it will sort of squeal and try to survive. And I think it's the best kind of, this is the scariest moment for me. It's the best mislead in the film when they try to make it look like Gary's infected and MacReady's arguing with him and like, we'll do you last. And then absentmindedly putting the thing into the dish that he's got, which then just jumps out at him and he's like, oh crap. Because at that point, I think even he was convinced it was going to be nothing and he would get to Gary and that would be the one that would react. But I love the way they play that because it's such a clever little mislead of the audience that we're focusing on. We're focusing over to the left and something's happening to the right or whatever, you know. So I appreciated that anyway. What did you guys think, out of curiosity?
I think it was really clever.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think it was like, just like, it's like medbay scanning Among Us, you know. It's just like, it's a visual way to clear anybody. But it, yeah, the whole like, every cell is its own thing. And that's the only like, twist in terms of like, a character being revealed to be the thing that I was like, oh, damn, because if I'm correct, up to that point, the guy who's actually revealed didn't really have any evidence against him.
Yeah, like, no, that's like what I mean.
He was a pretty sound kind of character, like you kind of trust him, and then all of a sudden he just starts like jolting, and it's like, oh, nah, no.
That's why I like it, though, because I think it's, like I said, it's such clever misleading.
Oh, yeah,
The film is going to great pains to make you focus on Gary. Like, he's been acting weird the whole time. MacReady's definitely seemed to have like singled it down to laser focusing on him. The camera's only showing him. It's showing their argument between the two of them. And the actual guy whose blood he's testing, like you said, isn't even on screen until it reacts. And then you see it, obviously him start to mutate or whatever. And then Gary and the people that are stuck tied up just be like, ah, what the heck? Get us away from him. Get him out of here. I was like, yeah, exactly. That's another level of terror where you're like, these people that are in fact innocent are now tied up and basically just, you know, fish in a barrel for the thing, which is just like, ha-ha, thanks. And now they can't escape.
I watched it just a couple of days ago with someone else, and they've seen it several times now. And even now, they're guessing who is infected and who isn't. They can't remember. And I don't know if it's set up in that way so that it's there for rewatchability. But even now, there are times when I'm just thinking, is it him? Because just the way it's set up, I think they've done he's done a really good job with it.
I think that's personally a bit of one of the flaws that I would point to, because I think part of that is the fact that no character other than like MacReady and Childs, I guess, has any character, so there's nothing to latch onto. So I didn't really particularly care which one of them was infected because we didn't know anything about them at that point. Like, we got to know Blair, so I think that was fair enough, and that was a good decision. And yes, I obviously, you know, because of them being big movie stars, we know, you know, Kurt Russell, Keith David, and Wilford Brimley now. But the rest of them, I was like, this could be anybody, and I don't really know who they are.
I have a fondness for Palmer.
I don't even know. I don't even know who that is.
Palmer's the one that did turn out to be the thing on the couch.
See, I can't remember him doing anything until that point, though.
You know, I mean, he's a stereotype, but he was your laid-back 60s stoner type. He always had a blunt in his hand, and I think he was a pilot along with MacReady of the helicopter. It mentions it at the start, and he wants to go out in the helicopter, and he immediately shuts him down, and so he comes out with that like deadpan line. Oh, okay,
thanks for considering it. I get who you mean now, but yeah, that's the least developed kind of, like, I was struggling because I knew I was reviewing it. I was like, I'll try and get a handle on who I could name. And like I said, I could tell you who MacReady is, who Childs is, who Blair is. I know Gary because he's basically the base commander and he's like the first guy to kill the poor Norwegian dude, which I felt was totally unnecessary because he breaks the window to do it, to shoot his pistol out of it. And I was like, just walk to the flipping door, man. What are you doing? Talk about over dramatic. You're in the middle of the Arctic. Why? Now you haven't got a window to protect you from the cold. Fool.
He did come across like he thought he was in a Western.
Exactly, yeah. Anyway, so yeah, may as well talk about the bit. Obviously, at the end, we go back and find out that not only is Blair infected, but he's been building something. We don't know what, whether it be, I think in the original, it's some kind of like nuclear weapon or atomic bomb or something that could potentially destroy the world. I think in here, it's hinted that it might be a ship to escape with or something. But then eventually they realize it's just given up and just wants to freeze, which again is another chilling, no pun intended, idea that it's just like, well, I'm defeated. They're all seeing through me. But if I just do what I did for like thousands of years, I'll go back, get frozen. Then there'll be a rescue team that comes and they will foolishly thaw me out because people are stupid. And then we'll try this again. So like, yeah, I kind of appreciated that. It kind of reinforces the, like I always say, the nihilistic tone, like reinforced again by them saying, we're not getting out of here alive. At the very end, that's MacReady and Childs, obviously, and yeah, like I said, as you said, Theo, the kind of jump scare about Blair when he finally pops out behind him and he clearly like assimilates Gary with that weird like touching his hand to his mouth and then there being a bizarre, I guess, melding of skin or something. It's like a mushy mouth effect. I don't know how else to put it. And then it basically turns into a Tremors thing or a giant sandworm to pop out of them. which is cool. I liked the effects on that, actually. I really did. And I loved that it, so when it comes out and it's a bizarre mess of like dog teeth and jaws, and then there's still one of the chap's faces at the top, like just waving around. I was like, all right, I appreciate the effects on this. This is pretty cool. Yeah. And then obviously, as I said, the ending, I really, really like the ambiguity of the ending that you don't know if it's either of them, if it's both of them, and the fact that it ends, instead of in any kind of way that you might expect, it just ends with, well, we'll just sit here a while, see what happens. I was like, yes. Yeah. And I do know that there are people that have like tried to analyze every frame of like, who is the thing at the end and stuff. I don't care. I don't want to know. There's theories about like, characters that aren't possessed, always the cinematographer puts a little glint or something in their eyes. And at the end, Childs doesn't have it. So it's clearly him. And I was like, I don't care. That defeats the point if you're looking for clues, as Carpenter himself has said. But then in his next breath, he says, like, but I know who the thing really is. I'm just not telling. And I was like, don't do that. I prefer there wasn't actually a clear answer, you know? So, yeah, that takes me through all of the, like, plotting and stuff. Before I move to the next bit, any thoughts on that from either of you, all of the stuff I've talked about?
I want to talk about the effects. You briefly mentioned, like, the whole the chap's face up at the top and all that. The effects in this film are just stunning. They're just works of art. Like, they all stick with you. Like you said, like the big blob monster face at the end, when the dog metamorphosizes into the thing. It's freaky as all hell, and it makes some weird, gooshy noises. You're like, it's uncomfortable, but it looks sick. And yeah, especially, like, the head crab, the head spider thing. That was badass. Oh, yeah.
I do talk about that. It might seem like I've jumped over a lot of that, but I talk about it in like direction rather than like plot, because I'm assuming it was just written as like this person is revealed rather than the sheer detail of exactly how gross it is and what happens. But like you said, the guy, the chest munching a guy's arms off, which apparently they did by hiring an amputee and putting fake arms on him that he could then just tear off. Because you don't see his face in that shot, obviously. I was like, that's clever. I like that. So yeah, that scene is great. The scene where the head just becomes a big spider, obviously. Great. And as I was kind of hinting at, I like the fact that it clearly tries to show that whatever it's previously assimilated, it kind of remembers in some kind of genetic memory, because the bizarre thing at the end does have dog faces and dog jaws on it, as well as like the people that it's assimilated. So I was like, that's so freaky. It looks so gross and horrifying, but it's still identifiable because you're like, oh, look, it's part of a dog. Ew. So, did you guys pick up on that or no?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not fair enough.
Also, I agree with you completely about the ending. Like, leave it ambiguous. I don't want to know the answer. It's perfect the way it is. Like, I you can have your own theories. Like, I imagine I'll probably rewatch it again and have my own theories on it. Because the first time I watched it, I think I was on the train of MacReady was infected at that point.
Ah.
Just because we followed it the whole time, it felt like that would be like the move to make to be like, oh, you followed this character all along, and now he's infected. Oh no.
Yeah. But
I prefer that, like, we don't get a clear answer. That we'll never get the answer, hopefully, and that is just some mysterious thing that we have to go through frame by frame to even get a hint of a clue.
Well, I like that it basically it's Schrodinger's ending, isn't it? Because it could be, it kind of lets you have your cake and eat it in that it could do any of the endings they wanted. Like, if you choose to believe neither of them were infected, but they let themselves freeze to death because, you know, it's the heroic thing to do to stop the thing from escaping, you could say that happened. If you want to believe they're both infected and that there's a chance that it's a really bleak ending, and if rescue comes, it might start to take over the whole world off screen. You could believe that if you want to. If you want to believe one of them is, but the other one's just scuppering them by not giving any away. Fair enough. So I kind of like I said, I like not knowing because I prefer the idea that all options are open to you that way.
More distressing if they're both not infected. That'd be so sad.
That's what I mean, though. But that's kind of the ending Carpenter wanted, which is like nobody's infected, but they let themselves freeze to death because their thinking is, well, we can't be rescued because if we're rescued, who knows if this thing is attached to our clothes or would somehow get its way onto the rescue chopper or whatever. So instead, we'll just die.
Also, if you think about it, the sense of like if one of them is infected, the other one isn't, and they're just going to wait it out, then whoever, if which one of them is infected, they got what they want. They get to freeze again.
Yeah.
Like this is a no win situation. That's the perfect type of ending. It's just a no win situation, especially for a horror film.
That's the point. It's thoroughly nihilistic, isn't it? Like, there's no good victory, really, is there?
There's no way you can win this.
Exactly, yeah. Awesome. Cool. Any thoughts before I move to acting, DK?
No, I just think it's a really well-done script. And, you know, I mean, you've mentioned, obviously, that you have problems, apart from the main characters differentiating. But I do think, for the most part, they're quite well-defined. The only one I feel sorry for, who I think got short shrift, is Fuchs, because he's the one that alerts MacReady. He's the one that's helping MacReady, and then he just kind of gets shuffled off screen.
Yeah, there is. I think I read somewhere there's a deleted scene or something that deals with it, but they didn't like the effect or it didn't quite pan out. So yes, he just disappears off screen, and you assume he's killed or taken over or whatever. But again, I couldn't point out to what he'd done prior to that. So I'm sorry, that's another character. I was like, I've written the name down and I was like, which one's Fuchs? I don't have a clue. sorry. but having said that, I did read that the original novel, the outpost base has like 70 odd people or whatever. And one of the first things they decided to do in adapting it was like, let's say there's about 12. trying to give like 70 people character development, it's not going to really work, is it? So yeah, appreciate that. Yeah, so just some notes on the acting from me then. Like I said, when they first find the corpse, I actually thought there was a little bit of overacting from the way they were all like, oh, I'm going to puke, But now that you tell me that that was probably just an actual natural reaction, I kind of can't blame them for that because that was real, so fair enough. I love the way, like I said, Wilfred Brimley is a great actor anyway, so his paranoid but ultimately wise breakdown, I think, is really well played. And whilst it's happening, I genuinely felt sorry for Windows as he's like kind of bloodstained and cowering in the corner, like, oh, he's going to kill me or whatever. But then there's the complete flip side of that. Windows starts acting super creepy during the blood test. So then I'm like, oh, I felt bad for you earlier, and now I'm starting to suspect you. Kurt Russell is great, obviously. I think he has the commanding presence you need to believe that this is a guy who would take charge and that they would listen to and eventually follow. The idea of him being so weary as well, you can kind of sense him getting more and more tired. And even as he's making the recording, he just seems knackered by it all. Keith David, like we mentioned, he either comes off as a great badass or a bit of an arse, but either way, it's a good performance of it. I love how he sort of, whether he's an asshole or not, he comes off with this bravado for the entire sort of thing. And then when he suspects Gary, they're all tied up and then the thing busts out. He just immediately, he's terrified, he's desperate. He's like, oh, I don't want to get away. Oh. And I was like, all right, the facade just immediately drops as soon as you're in actual danger, which I appreciate. That was all of my thoughts about the acting. What did you guys think? Anything particular?
I think there's not a bad performance in the entire bunch, if I'm being honest. Even down to...
even down to whoever trained that dog.
Did a special. Oh, that dog's brilliant. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
All the dogs are brilliant.
Yeah, well, the others don't really have a lot to do, but yeah, I appreciate
it. Well, they managed to get training to, like, bark at the other dog. Like, that couldn't have been easy.
Well, you know, they're dogs. You probably just put a rabbit in the middle of the room and told them they, you know, put it in a cage they couldn't get to or something. I don't know. That being mean, I guess. But no, that dog that was walking around looking creepy was a very good job. Good animal actor. And no animals were harmed, don't worry. It was all just mannequins and effects and Stan Winston maquettes and things when they were getting taken over. I did love that effect as well, by the way. The fact that the dog just becomes a mass of crap and then eventually grows what looks like human hands to try and push through the roof and everything.
Yeah. Oh,
creepy. But, yeah. So anything else before I move to directing then?
No, that's everything I've got.
Awesome. Well, I've talked about a couple of things, the saucer and the kind of sheer empty space. I love how the dog kennel scene is a masterclass in how to play one of these things, because it starts off briefly very tense. Like, you can hear the wind howling. There's no music. You're just focusing on this staring dog, so that when it does eventually break out into complete madness, I think it's all the more effective and shocking, because, yeah, you don't necessarily see it coming and you're still tense, but it just springs that on you. So, yeah. I've mentioned it already,
Love the cuts. The where they just fade to black rather than just immediately cut from one scene to the other. I think that helps add to the tension.
Yeah, it's a good idea directing in general anyway, because it's less jarring than, like you said, quick cuts or whatever. So, and I think it perhaps also serves to make you think you don't know how much time has passed, which is handy in a situation like this. I mentioned already, I like the fact that they go to the trouble of showing you the computer program being run that says, you know, there's a 75% chance that it'll, you know, take you all over, and then it'll be a matter of months or whatever until the entire world population's taken over. I was like, talk about setting big stakes in that case, you know? It's like, okay, we're talking about literally taking over the world here. Gotcha. Oof.
I think that computer scene was a last minute addition, if I remember right.
Really? Oh, yeah. Well, that's interesting. So cool. Yeah, because now I think about it, there really isn't anywhere else where they sort of mention, like, we can't let it escape because it might take over or whatever. So I can see why, maybe. I love that you see a guy actually being absorbed in the case of Bennings. Like, you see the start of the process because he's just been spat on or whatever.
Yeah.
And even though, like, they apparently had a massive, way more elaborate sort of taking over mutation scene for Bennings, and in the end had to scrap it and use claws that were apparently intended for a completely different monster movie, I think that scene works really incredibly well, whether it's the way it's, like, subtly directed or the acting or whatever. I found that genuinely scary, that, like, you just see what looks like him as per normal till he falls on his knees, and then they come around to see him, and, like I said, it's just the most bizarre claws and this open mouth shriek because it can't even speak properly. And I was like, that's effective for me, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said before, that was the only scene that actually scared me in terms of being scared.
I can see why. It's definitely
so unhuman. And like, the effects are gorgeous. Like, the rest
when
of
you
the
think
film.
that was literally just to save money because they couldn't afford what they planned to do, I was like, well, it worked.
I think it worked perfectly. I imagine if they got what they wanted, I don't think it would have been as good as this. Because it was all over the top and, like, turned into a big blob monster, it would kind of ruin it, like, later in the film, where you kind of get those kind of wacky, like, morphing between dogs and humans, and instead, like, the first kind of one you see is just his hands. So it's like, okay, so it's not going to be too bad. It's just, you know, it looks a bit weird. And then later on, it's like, my whole stomach is a mouth. So it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, this got very odd.
And the scream, that scream sends me.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. See, it's the little subtle things, but yeah, just the sound of that and everything, and the way it's performed, like I said, the fact that it's you know, they even say it's not Bennings, and then he's just, like you mentioned, DK, he's got like a 1,000-yard stare, and he just opens his mouth and screams, and it's very ending of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the not-as-good remake. So...
Outside Nelson.
I like how kind of scary MacReady looks when he's all frozen and locked out. So as kind of Theo was hinting at, that adds to your suspicion of him. Again, we mentioned it, but we may as well mention how cool and iconic is the kind of chest bite scene when he's just defibrillating and then the hands are bitten off. There's, can you imagine seeing that for the first time? I can vaguely remember it and being like, what the F just happened? And then, like I said, the fact that it just becomes a whole mess and there's one head, you know, on a little weird coil thing floating in the air and the other one detaching.
So, so much happens.
And it still throws me, that scene.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. I just can't, I'd love to know who was imaginative enough to think, well, this is what's going to happen. It's going to grow a giant jaw in its chest. Then one head's going to float off somewhere. Then the other one's going to detach and become a spider that they then can't fight. You know? So, but on a plot level, I also appreciated the fact that somebody wisely points out that, like, if we do suspect MacReady, he did just do a pretty good job of killing the actual, you know, infected thing. So it doesn't really stand to reason at that point when he's basically torched the creature.
But then again, that's like drawing like attention away from himself. Like every possible maneuver every character does, it can be explained by just, well, it could be the creature playing smart. Like, he knows the jig's up with the other one. So he's like, oh, let's kill that. And actually kills the other one. It's like, well, it's kind of smart.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Definitely.
This is very hard to, like, believe anybody.
That's the point of the plot, though, isn't it? You could constantly second-guess yourself, and you never know, and that's what the characters were obviously feeling, so...
Yeah, that's cool. Because, I mean, immediately prior to Palmer being revealed, he's the one that comes out with the, you know, you've got to be fucking kidding.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I never even picked that up, but you're right, absolutely, yeah. That's a good point. Why would he be... anyway. That's clever, I like that. I do think, though, in terms of the effects, I have to say, and I feel bad because I know that Rob Bottin basically hospitalized himself. During the blood test transformation, when they reveal who it is, it does go very original Evil Dead for me. I was like, okay, this is now looking a bit too low budget, kind of. All right. I mean, I think it was the same year as Evil Dead, so maybe that's fair enough, but I just think it's so much better in all the others anyway.
Stark cranberry sauce.
Which bit was that? The one where the head's kind of chomping down on the other head.
That's how it ends, but it's just like, as it first sort of starts to mutate when they've revealed it, it just becomes, it looks very like kind of a shrunken-headed Deadite, Evil Dead character. Because the head shrinks around it and the eyes bulge out and then...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean now. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying, yeah?
Yeah.
So, it just, like I said, that effect for me didn't... I wouldn't say it didn't work because it was fine, but it just wasn't as good as the others. Particularly when it followed, like, the chest biting and the spider head and everything that were just flawless, more or less, you know? So, anyway. The last note I have on the direction is just that even the aspect ratio is oppressive. Apparently, Carpenter fought to have it in this aspect ratio so that you feel boxed in, which I was like, okay, again, I appreciate it. Didn't even really notice until I read about it. So, yeah. Awesome. Any other notes on direction before I move a little bit further on?
No, like I said, I just think he's done a beautiful job with this, and it shows what he can do when, you know, given a budget.
Definitely, 100%. Awesome. You're going to hate me because the next thing that I have to say, the next section I have was sounds and music, and I have to say I'm not a fan of the Ennio Morricone score, even though I know you are, TK, probably.
I love the Carpenter side of things, right, as I love all Carpenter soundtracks. I think the man's just... so talented. There is one part, I think it's when they're in the Norwegian base and they discover the ice block that it came from, and Morricone's soundtrack at that point, it's just like someone strangling about 25 cats.
I picked
it's
up on a
so
lot.
High pitched. I have to turn the sound down at that point.
Yeah, I found a lot of it was like that, and a lot of it's jarring, and a lot of it seems intrusive and kind of detrimental to any tension because, yeah, it's just like, well, I'm now thinking something's going to happen because it was quiet a minute ago, and now all of a sudden, like you said, it's like as if somebody just sat on a violin while strangling a cat, and I'm like, all right, what's this about then?
I mean, I love the soundtrack on the whole, but there are occasional, you know, motifs in there that I just think, could have done without that, really. It's a bit too much.
I found it a bit obvious, I would say, ultimately, is what I would describe it as. A bit like, all right, it's on the nose. I did find out after I made this note, by the way, that the score was nominated for worst score at the Razzies.
But what?
Yep.
What?
Well, I'm just saying, I clearly agreed. Yeah, in terms of like things that were effective to scare us, the weird what sounded like dying baby sounds when they kill Windows thing, they really bothered me. Like they grated right through me to a primal level. I was like, what if I don't know how they got those effects, but my word, that's freaky.
The sound design for the creature itself is just phenomenal. Yeah.
Definitely, 100%. Awesome. So I'm going to briefly talk before I go to the next level of the game about the reception. But before I do that, did you have any last thoughts just about the film, you know, things you liked, disliked, or, you know, wanted to shout out before we move on?
There's one scene, I think it's where the dog is originally transforming and the big kind of claw comes out. I don't think that's aged as well as the rest of the effects around it. That kind of drew me out a bit. But for a 1982 movie, I mean, we're 40 years on now, it still holds up remarkably well. And other than that, I think that a couple of minor, and they are really minor problems such as that, I just think it's a fantastic movie.
Mm. We know your opinion of John Carpenter, so that doesn't surprise me. Awesome. What about you, Theo? Anything before I move to the reception the film got?
I think we pretty much touched on everything I'd want to touch on. Like, I think the film is amazing. Like, I think it's pretty perfect in terms of, like, what I'd want to see from this type of film. And, yeah, the one standout scene for me is definitely when they're in the snow and the scream. And then that whole speech as well, that's just, like, that point of the film stands out to me so much.
I'm going to move us to the next section, which would be the favourite character moment and line. I'll start with Will's because he did send me them. So I think you know, why not? May as well. So Will said, let's see.
Movie good, in it? That's probably
I was trying to find the screen cap of the Discord conversation. His favourite character was apparently, in his words, my man Gary. He didn't elaborate as to why. I don't know why, but okay. His favourite scene was the blood testing scene, and his favourite line was, they're Norwegian, which I guess is for the humour of the Lennox Swedish, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, that gives Will's 2 cents on this anyway. But Theo, you're our guest, so I'll come to you next and say, who's your favourite character, first of all?
I am a basic man. I like MacReady.
That's fair enough. What about you then, DK?
I'm just as basic. It's got to be MacReady, isn't it?
And I'm going to make it a hat trick of basicness because it's also MacReady.
I mean...
But with the proviso that that's because nobody really gets much character development. And I will say that even though I picked him, I do not like that he just straight up murders Clark. But yeah, anyway. Theo, then back to you. What's your favorite scene?
Priori. I've already talked about it, but the reveal, the first like proper thing reveal in the snow.
Oh, with Bennings being taken
over. Yeah, Bennings, that one.
Got you. Okay, cool. That's a good choice. DK?
I think it's going to have to be the defib scene.
That was a close second for me, but I actually have the same as Will. It was the blood test scene for me that was that came out on top. Awesome. So finally then, until we get conclusions and audience interaction and conclusions, Theo, what was your favourite line, if you can think of any from the film?
Wait, I want to see if I can... Well, one second, I just want to...
He's going to look up quotes on IMDb, so while he does that...
Yeah, you guys go first. I'll be with you in a minute.
That's fair enough. DK, do you want to give us your favourite line?
As much as I wanted it to be one of Palmer's, either the OK, thanks for thinking about it, though, and, you know, the obviously, you got to be fucking kidding. I think my favourite's got to be MacReady's, the whole, I know I'm human, and if you were all these things, then you just attack me right now speech.
So I know you aren't all, yeah. Okay, fair enough. I was so wanted to put you got to be fucking kidding because it's the one that stuck in my mind on the first viewing of this because it was very much how I was feeling and I just appreciate that line. But in the end, I had to go with the conversation between MacReady and Blair, which is Blair saying, I don't know who to trust. And especially MacReady's response, I know what you mean. Trust is a hard thing to come by these days. So yeah, that would be my pick. Theo, have you had a chance to scout the IMDb quote page yet?
This one.
Oh, that's bone chilling. Oh. Kudos for looking up the exact scene and getting it nailed, though. Well
say
done.
If we can cut that as a quote, that one.
I'm going to allow it because, heck, man, you went to the trouble of finding it. So definitely allow it.
So just bone chilling. Just awesome.
Definitely.
It's like, this is a bit of a not a long tangent, but my two favorite sounds in all of cinema is that one, that scream. And in 127 hours, when James Franco is cutting the nerve in his arm.
Oh, no, no, no.
Those two sounds are my favorite just because they make me so. Oh.
Yep. Right, before we get to the conclusions and our final scores, then I'm going to go to the audience interaction section. As usual, I did put out on social media what are your opinions of the movie The Thing. We didn't get a lot of responses, I've only got four. So I might as well read them out. This obviously isn't counting Will's, as he's included amongst our conclusion. So Jonathan Deakin on Twitter says, it's the only film that has ever made me jump out of my seat. I was 6 feet tall and weighed 20 stone when I first watched this. But when it leapt out of a container, I leapt out of my seat. So, yeah. At Mangler112 says, an absolute masterpiece, my favorite horror film ever. At eKelly1701 says, The Thing is a positively brilliant film that goes far beyond gross-out effects in exploring what happens to people when they are facing certain death. So powerful I couldn't watch it for decades after a viewing at 17 that gave me nightmares for years. Sorry about that.
Oh, my sure.
And finally...
Make people relive trauma.
Right, so, as I say, what we're going to do now, we are going to give a conclusion and a score out of 5 stars. That's how we always do it. And once again, I'm just going to start by giving Will's, because he's not here, so that way it gets it out of the way. Will's conclusion is simply, as we know, I do like my characters to have something to them, and the characters certainly do. The film does a great job at laying down each and every essential component of a competent film, and that's how it flies easily. Really tense, and in that respect, especially with its superior pace, shits on the OG Halloween. I had to read that, he did write it. The music is also rather brilliant. It's a great piece of media, but I think it falls short of a perfect score because I'm not typically into this genre, although this was a great time, and he gave it 4.5 stars. Dookie, so let me just see where we are. Right, we'll go to you next. Theo, do you want to go next? Or
yeah, can do.
Time to gather your thoughts. Okay, go for it.
All right, it's not going to be as structured as Will, but I'll give it a go. Inclusion, I think this film is phenomenal. I think it's deserves the appraisal it's getting nowadays, and I am flabbergasted at how it was initially treated on release. I think most of the characters are really likable, especially MacReady. It's one of the only films that kind of creeped me out in a sense that I've actually had a physical reaction to it, and films that can give you a physical reaction, I tend to latch on to more just because most films don't really do that for me. But yeah, that the practical effects are stupendous for the time and even hold up very well nowadays. And yeah, I personally quite like the score. I think there's only a few downplays, but the score in total, I think, is amazing. I really like this film a lot.
Okay, so stars out of 5 then.
I give it a 5 stars.
Wow, perfect score. Fair enough. And, okay, DK, we'll come to you next. Why not?
Okay, what's to say that's not already been said? John Carpenter took a plot line from a 1950s B-movie novella adaptation, went back to the source material, and gave us one of the all-time horror movie classics. Beautiful cinematography, amazing effects, great soundtrack, fantastic performances, and a script that keeps you guessing. I've said it before, and I'll continue to say it until I'm no longer physically able. 80s John Carpenter just cannot be beat, and I'm giving it a 5.
Well, 1978 John Carpenter can't be beat, but I'll let you.
Oh, man.
Jeez.
Right, I'm going to give my conclusion. It's not a total downer. I'll say that. No, I did have to rework this and stuff with Will, so apologies, it's a little bit long and it is written down, but I just said it's an absolute masterclass in showing paranoia and fear of the other. There's some good writing, lots of imaginative ideas, and brilliant direction. I'm not sure if it needs to be as grotesque and gory to tell the story, but the effect scenes only really bothered me on first viewing. So either the impact is dulled after the shock factor is gone, or I've just grown more desensitized and or seen way more weird shit by now. The lack of an introduction or any real development of most of the characters is a weak point, seeming like their obvious death fodder and making it a struggle to know their names or particularly care about them. More of this instead of gore might have been more effective for me. It's also a bit unclear how the alien takes you over, copies what happens to you as the original, etc. That said, this does a really good job emphasizing the effect and feeling of isolation. It portrays the detrimental impact of mistrust very well, though not quite as effectively as, say, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The direction is notably outstanding, but not as good as Halloween, which remains Carpenter's masterpiece in my eyes. That's a high bar, though. I should really hate the nihilistic tone, as it's not usually my thing, but I think it works incredibly well in this case, and it's a strength. In the end, I found this an enjoyable, easy watch. I wasn't especially tense, but then I've seen the movie a few times before, so there weren't exactly any surprises. There's some great acting, outstanding practical effects, and some truly iconic, well-staged scenes, but it's lacking that killer edge for me to put it into absolute top-level greatness or call it a favourite. Still, though, it's undeniably very good, and I give it 4 out of 5. So, yeah, hopefully justified my score there with all that. And as I said, I am including Will's score in the final score. So that between the four of us, then that makes the average 4.625 out of 5. So we'll call it 4.6. Why not? So 4.6 out of 5 for The Thing. Pretty dang close to a perfect score, especially for a film with four people reviewing it, because that tends to knock the scores down a bit. So congratulations to The Thing for a very high score. And yeah, awesome. Any last thoughts, anybody?
It's John Carpenter, innit?
That'll do it.
Pretty good.
John Carpenter, innit? Nice. Right, well, all that remains for me to do then is to thank Theo for joining us for this very special crossover Halloween episode. If he's able to get it up and edited in his own way, you may well be able to see this on the Big Screen Podcast, because I am sending the recording to Will. You'll definitely catch it on Silver Screen Podcast, though. And yeah, it's been really fun. I've enjoyed the games that we played, the little Halloween-y ones. And I think I still really enjoyed the movie. It feels like I was being perhaps a bit too negative for a 4 out of 5 score, but I did really enjoy it. And I enjoyed talking about it with you guys, even though I've perhaps rambled a bit more than either of you. So awesome. So again, Theo, thanks again for joining us. Is there anywhere you want to plug, or your social medias or anything like that?
Well, on Letterboxd, the Big Screen Podcast, mm-hmm. Kind of speaks for yourself. My personal YouTube channel, that wouldn't go amiss if I gave a little shout out there and trying to get some traction on it.
For sure, yeah. What's that? Can people find that?
Soup Productions.
I did leave that in the comments as well the last time you guested, but I'll do that again. So thank you. And hopefully we'll have you back a few times, I'm hoping, next year.
I'd be happy to.
Will's running much, so I will... I've got your contact details, and I'll just bug the crap out of you till you join us a few times, probably.
It's been more than ever, too. It's been really fun.
Awesome. I look forward to next time, then. And thanks for joining us if you've made it this far, audience. I hope you enjoyed it as well, and I hope you're enjoying the Halloween season.